days before it would have to post the collateral. That meant he had until Wednesday, or at the latest Thursday, to come up with an astronomical amount of money. J.P. Morgan's Black feared they had even less time. By his count, Tuesday morning would be their deadline. After the meeting, he pulled Willemstad aside and warned him, "You guys are going to get downgraded, so you better start figuring out now what to do." Willemstad nodded. "We need to prepare for that. I totally agree with that." Black left the building even more down on the company than when he had arrived. Nobody, he thought, was moving nearly as fast as he needed to. In the General Motors building, which occupies an entire block on Fifth Avenue and 59th Street, Harvey Miller, the legendary bankruptcy lawyer at Weil, Gottschall & Mangy's, got up from his desk and began pacing. As he made a circuit of his office, he gazed at the miniature Texaco trucks and Eastern Airlines jets that dotted his bookshelves, mementos of two of his most famous cases. At 75, Miller was considered the dean of bankruptcy law, and he billed clients nearly $1,000 an hour for his services. Besides Texaco and Eastern, he had been involved in the bankruptcies of Sunbeam, Drexel Burnham Lambert, and Enron, and was also among the lawyers who represented the city of New York during its financial crisis in the 1970s. Always reassuringly calm, he was also known for his deftly tailored suits, his love of opera, and his ability to speak in long, eloquent paragraphs. He had grown up in the Gravesend neighborhood of Brooklyn, the son of a wood flooring salesman, and was the first in his family to receive an education beyond high school, attending Brooklyn College. After a stint in the Army, he went to Columbia Law. At the time, bankruptcy was one of the few areas of corporate finance that smaller, predominantly Jewish law firms dominated in the still WASP-infected industry. In 1963, Miller joined the small bankruptcy shop Seligson & Morris. 6 years later, Ira Milstein, the governance guru, recruited Miller to start a bankruptcy and restructuring practice at Weil, Gottschall. Earlier that afternoon, the firm's chairman, Stephen J. Donhauser, had phoned him and posed a startling question. Would the firm be available to do some preliminary work on Lehman, just in case? Miller said he understood. He had been reading the financial press. Lehman was a very important client, the firm's biggest, in fact, and the source of more than $40 million in fees annually. He knew the company very well. Donhauser had received a call from Stephen Birkenfeld, a Lehman managing director, who told him they should get their ducks in order if things didn't go well in the next 72 hours. Before Birkenfeld ended the call, he insisted that Donhauser keep their conversation confidential. Birkenfeld hadn't even told Fuld that he was contacting Weil, Gottschall. As a bankruptcy lawyer, Miller was well accustomed to engaging in these delicate pas de deux with clients. "Bankruptcy," he once said, "is like dancing with an 800-pound gorilla. You dance as long as the gorilla wants to dance." Just a few hours later, however, Miller received another call from the embattled bank. "I'm Tom Russo, the chief legal officer of Lehman Brothers," the voice on the other end of the line bellowed. "Are you working on Lehman?" Miller, who did not know Russo, was taken aback. "Well, yes, as it happens." Russo had no interest in discussing any details, but wanted to deliver a message. "You know, you can't talk about this to anybody. It's a very tense situation. We can't have any rumors coming out." Miller was about to assure him that he appreciated the urgency of the matter when Russo asked anxiously, "How many people do you have working on it?"
Maybe four," Miller told him. "It's preliminary at this point."
"Yes, preliminary," Russo insisted. "Don't add any more people. We've got to keep it contained." Russo ended the call, leaving a baffled Miller to wonder precisely what was going on. With his team over at Sullivan & Cromwell working with Bank of America, Dick Fuld decided to call Ken Lewis in Charlotte. After all, if they were going to do a deal, he figured that they should start talking CEO to CEO. When Fuld reached Lewis, he launched into a heartfelt soliloquy about working together and how excited he was about the merger, marrying Lehman Brothers' top-flight investment banking franchise with Bank of America's massive commercial bank. The resources of the combined entity, he suggested, could match those of J.P. Morgan and Citigroup,
finally making Bank of America a true financial supermarket. Lewis listened patiently, not exactly certain how to respond. In his mind, he wasn't negotiating with Fuld. He was negotiating with the government. Whatever Fuld had to say was, frankly, irrelevant. Before ending the call, Fuld, feeling confident, said, "You and I both know we're doing this deal. Glad we're partners." BlackRock was in the middle of a two-day board meeting at its headquarters on 50th Street, just off Madison Avenue, when the markets closed for the day. As a part owner of BlackRock, Merrill has two seats on BlackRock's board, and John Thain and Greg Fleming, who were attending that day, quickly consulted their BlackBerries to check the closing prices. Merrill's shares had fallen 16.6% to $19.43, the most of any investment bank that day besides Lehman, whose shares had tumbled 42% to $4.22. If Lehman was in this much trouble, the general thinking seemed to be going, Merrill could well be next. During a break in the meeting, Fleming stepped outside to make a phone call. He had been thinking all day about the conversation he had had with Herlihy about the possibility of a deal with Bank of America. He had yet to approach Thain about it, waiting for just the right opportunity to present itself. He had, however, spoken privately with John Finnegan, a Merrill board member with whom he was close. Finnegan, who, like Fleming, tended to be nervous by nature, had worried that Thain would have little interest in selling the firm. He had, after all, only been named CEO 10 months earlier. The person Fleming needed to contact now was Rajan Cohen, also a close friend, and he knew Lehman's lawyer. Fleming was eager to get a reading on how the talks with Bank of America were going, and how desperate the situation had become for Lehman, and consequently for Merrill. When Cohen, who had been in a conference room with the Lehman team meeting with Bank of America, stepped out to take the call, Fleming greeted him casually, as if this were merely a social communication. After the obligatory pleasantries, he offhandedly remarked on Merrill's stock price decline, and then told Cohen, "We're thinking about our options. I don't know how much runway we have." But Cohen was quickly on to Fleming. He knew Merrill was in no position to buy Lehman. And, being a student of the M&A business, he knew Fleming probably wanted to do a deal with Bank of America, thwarting Lehman's own efforts. "There's not much I can say," Cohen told him. Abandoning any attempt to conceal his motives, Fleming confided in Cohen, "We've got to do a deal. The numbers are looking too risky. If Lehman goes, we'll be next." Cohen didn't know how to respond, other than to excuse himself as quickly as possible. For now, at least, he would keep the conversation confidential. When Steve Black got back to his office at J.P. Morgan from AIG, he described the meeting to Diamond as a fucking nightmare. He asked Tim Maine to call Brian Schreiber to get an update on AIG's latest forecast and to see if Schreiber had signed the engagement letter, essentially a specification of J.P. Morgan's terms for trying to put AIG back together again. Maine told Black that the document had not yet been signed, but that he would call that afternoon to check on its status. "Can we schedule my weekly beating at 2 p.m.?" he asked, only half-joking. His relationship with the AIG folks remained as frosty as ever. When Maine finally got through to Schreiber, he asked without any preamble, "So, where are you on the engagement letter?" Schreiber had always believed that the terms of the engagement letter were excessive. Not only was J.P. Morgan asking for a $10 million fee, but the bank was also demanding that it be guaranteed work on any big AIG assignment over the next 2 years. "Where are you on the repo commitment?" Schreiber retorted indignantly. Maine, who was already angry about rumors he'd heard that Schreiber had also been talking to Blackstone and Deutsche Bank, finally lost his temper. "Are you fucking kidding? You think we're going to lend you money?" he barked. But he was just getting warmed up. "You're running a shitty process. Your company is fucked. You're working with other bankers that you're not telling us about. You're carving it all up." "Don't scream at me," Schreiber replied coldly. "I'm not going to take this from you. I've got to talk to Bob." 5 minutes later, Schreiber was angrily recounting the conversation to Willemstad, who in turn called Black to demand an explanation for Maine's behavior. Instead of offering an apology, though, Black exploded at him as well. "There's no sense of urgency down there. You guys don't have anything close to the information that you need to be trying to make decisions, Black said. Every time we ask for something, you drag your feet. We sent an engagement letter 3 weeks ago, and Brian is still dicking around with signing it. We'll do whatever you want us to do, Black finally said wearily. But if this is the way it's going to go, then you might as well... We should probably resign. You should get somebody else. This has gotten to a poisonous point, and the people that work for you don't get the position that you guys are in. If you were that upset about it, why didn't you just call me? Willemstad asked. When the call came in from Ken Lewis late Thursday afternoon, Paulson knew what he was about to hear. We've looked at it, and we can't do it. We can't do it without government assistance, Lewis said levelly. We just can't do it, because we can't get there. Like many of Lehman's critics at the time, including the anxious shareholders who were flooding the market with sell orders, Lewis said that the valuations that Lehman had placed on its assets were far too high. Buying them could expose Bank of America to huge risks. Given that Bob Diamond of Barclays had already come to him, hat in hand, looking for a government assist in a Lehman deal, Paulson had fully expected Lewis would do the same. But Paulson still wasn't prepared to resort to drawing on federal money, at least not yet. It was politically unpalatable, especially with the Fannie and Freddie bailouts still making headlines. And if this was going to become a negotiation, Paulson didn't want to show all his cards so early on. He knew, however, that he needed to keep Bank of America in the hunt, so he offered, "Okay, if you need help on assets, you tell us what you need help on, and we will come up with a way to get there." Lewis, nonplussed, replied, "I thought you said there would be no public money." "I will work on this," Paulson promised. "We will get the private sector to get involved." Private sector involvement was a concept that Paulson and Geithner had been discussing all day, the assembly of a consortium of banks to help subsidize a sale of Lehman if Bank of America or Barclays refused to do the deal on its own. But neither Paulson nor Geithner had completely fleshed out the idea yet, and even in the best of times, herding bankers was a feat far from easy. Lewis paused, not at all pleased with what Paulson seemed to be suggesting. He didn't want to get involved in a quasi-public-private rescue. He wanted a Jamie deal. And he knew full well that his rivals were unlikely to want to foot the bill so he could buy Lehman for a song. Lewis nonetheless agreed that he would keep examining Lehman with an eye toward making a bid. With so much at stake, he assumed he would ultimately get some sort of assistance, whatever form it might take. On Thursday afternoon, David Boies, Hank Greenberg's lawyer, arrived at the offices of Simpson Thacker to meet with AIG's lawyers, Dick Beatty, the chairman of the firm, and Jamie Gamble. Only a small circle knew about the meeting or what it was intended to accomplish. After 4 years of public battles, AIG was about to reach a settlement with Greenberg, one that would bring him back into the company fold. Willemstad had instructed Beatty and Gamble to get in a room with Boies and hammer out a deal once and for all. Given the tumult in the market, Willemstad was eager to announce that Greenberg was returning to AIG as its chairman emeritus. The news would certainly come as a shock, but Willemstad was hoping the settlement might buy them some time and goodwill from investors, many of whom were still Greenberg loyalists. Willemstad also knew that Greenberg was fervent about helping AIG raise capital, and given Greenberg's deep relationships with wealthy investors in Asia and the Middle East, he could prove to be an asset. They still had to work out the details, but they had come to an agreement in principle that would resolve the dispute. AIG would turn over $15 million worth of artwork, papers, and property that Greenberg believed was his, and AIG would pay for Greenberg to defend himself in the dozens of shareholder lawsuits that had been brought against him. In return, Greenberg would turn over somewhere between 25 to 50 million AIG shares that had been held by Star International in a trust and had been at the center of the dispute. In total, the settlement would cost Greenberg as much as $860 million, based on AIG's share price that day, but it would end AIG's $4.3 billion lawsuit against him, and would reinstall him within the company that he loved so dearly. With the basics of the settlement agreed, Boies, wearing a blue blazer and casual black Merrell shoes, thanked the other men and suggested that they try to memorialize the arrangement by getting Willemstad and Greenberg in the same room to wrap it up the following week. "Call me this weekend," Boyce said to them as he turned to leave. Paolo Tonucci, Lehman's global treasurer, looked horror-stricken as he set down his cell phone. "I've got to talk to you right now," he said quietly to Bart McDade and Rajan Cohen. "We've got a real problem." Everything had been going smoothly at Sullivan and Cromwell's Midtown offices, where they had been helping Bank of America with its due diligence. But now, as Tonucci revealed, J.P. Morgan is pulling another $5 billion in collateral from us. I just got off the phone with Jane Byers Russo, head of J.P. Morgan's broker-dealer unit. She says that we need to wire it by tomorrow, and she might pull another $10 billion by the weekend. "What?" Cohen asked, clearly dismayed by the demands. "This sounds unbelievable. I don't understand this. I know everyone's in panic mode, but this is too much." Tonucci shared the news with his boss, Ian Lowett, Lehman's CFO, and the rest of the room. "This is bullshit," McGee yelled out, breaking an awkward silence. Tonucci and Lowett called Full to tell him the news and to set up a conference call with Jamie Dimon. "Listen, we need you to send us the collateral," Dimon told the group when he finally clicked into the call, saying it was a fair request to make given Lehman's deteriorating position. Full calmly told Dimon he'd have his team work on it. Tonucci, however, whispered to the Lehman team, "Does Dick not understand? It's almost operationally impossible for us to do that." Dimon, too, worried that Fuld might be treating the matter far too casually. "Are you taking notes?" Dimon snapped. When the call ended, McDade was apoplectic. "We have to call the Fed," he said. "Jamie can't just do this." Cohen, who had had the most experience of any of them with Fed matters, wasn't so sure. "I'm quite sure Jamie has been there before us," he told them. "Jamie's tough. He wouldn't have done this without the tacit approval of the Fed." For the next 10 minutes, the room was a cacophony of different conversations taking place simultaneously, all on the common theme of, "They're trying to put us out of business." Finally, they decided that the best step to take was to call Tim Geithner. When Cohen reached Geithner and put him on speakerphone, he quickly explained the situation to him. Geithner appeared unconcerned, as if he had been expecting their call. McGee shot a nervous glance at McDade, as if to say, "We're fucked." "I cannot advise a bank not to protect itself," Geithner said unperturbedly. Cohen, politely hoping to get Geithner to realize that he believed J.P. Morgan was doing this to undermine its rival, asked, "Do they need that protection?" "I'm not in a position to judge that," Geithner answered. At 6 p.m., Paulson joined a strategy call with Geithner, Bernanke, and Cox. He felt they were about to go into crisis mode and feared another Bear Stearns-like weekend. This time, however, he was determined that it end differently. He believed they needed to prepare what he called a LTCM-like solution. In other words, he was committed to the idea of encouraging firms in the private sector to band together and put their own money up to somehow save Lehman Brothers. Geithner was supporting the concept, and apparently some Wall Street chiefs were as well. Geithner had received calls from both John Thain of Merrill Lynch and Vikram Pandit of Citigroup earlier in the day, suggesting just such a solution. Paulson was also deeply concerned about the apparent lack of resolve of both Bank of America and Barclays to cross the finish line. He had come to feel that Bank of America was merely going through the motions, and was anxious that Barclays wasn't especially serious about coming to an agreement either. "Listen, the thing about these Brits is that they always talk, and they never close," he told them. He also had a particular instinct about Barclays' chairman, John Varley, whom he remembered from his Goldman days as a waffler. "Let me tell you," Paulson said, "Varley is a weak man." Perhaps most important, Paulson stressed, was that they couldn't afford the political liability of putting up government money for Lehman as they had for Bear Stearns. "I can't be Mr. Bailout," he insisted. And given that everyone on the conference call had already lived through the backlash of that experience, they hardly needed convincing about not wanting to repeat it. Still, Geithner was a bit hesitant about taking such a severe stance in public, but only because, as he explained, "We don't want to scare people away. We need as many bidders in this as possible." Nonetheless, he quickly fell in line, and the four men made a pact. Unless something miraculous happened, they would plan to place calls to the CEOs of the major Wall Street houses late on Friday and have them all come down to the NY Fed, where they'd press them to come up with a private solution. In the meantime, Paulson instructed them, the message should be clear. No bailouts. Brian Schreiber, removing his thick-framed glasses to rub his eyes, could see from his examination of AIG's daily cash tally that the firm could soon be out of money if it didn't start selling assets quickly. He nervously began working through the list of people whom he could call, whose companies would be capable of providing assistance almost immediately. The first name that occurred to him was Chris Flowers. His fund had several billion dollars available to buy financial services assets, and as a former financial services banker, he understood the insurance business well enough that he could move instantly if he was interested. They had also worked together before. Flowers had sought to partner with the firm to buy some smaller insurance companies in the past. Schreiber tracked down Flowers over at Sullivan and Cromwell, still doing diligence on Lehman's books. "We have a huge problem," Schreiber told him. "We're going to run out of cash shortly. And you know, we only have, you know, one or two shots to get this right." "Well, I'm in the middle of Lehman here," Flowers replied. "I'm working with B of A." "Is there any way you could come down here tomorrow?" Schreiber persisted. "We'll come take a look," he said somewhat noncommittally, uncertain whether he'd be finished with Lehman by then, and then added, "I see this is really important." After ending his conference call with Geithner and Bernanke, Paulson summoned Michelle Davis, his head of communications, to his office. "So I talked to Lewis and Diamond. They're, of course, all saying that they want government money," he told her. "And we've got Pelosi and everybody else all over us," he added, referring to rumblings that the Speaker of the House had made expressing her disapproval of any more bailouts. Davis had brought with her a handful of articles that had already been published by the major papers on the Internet, and it was clear that a possible bailout would be the primary focus of the following day's news cycle. A Dow Jones article published at 7:03 p.m., just minutes earlier, opened, "With a beleaguered Lehman Brothers Holdings Incorporated likely to be sold, one key issue is what a backstop from the Federal Reserve, if it materialized, would look like." "You cannot have this in tomorrow's headlines, tomorrow's newspapers, saying this," Davis said, shaking her head. "Everyone is going to think, oh, Hank is coming with his checkbook. That is not the way you want to start this negotiation." As a former staffer herself, she was also aware of the Bush administration's stand on the matter, and knew how politically problematic it would be if the possibility of a bailout of a major Wall Street firm were even being entertained. Although the subject was left unspoken, both she and Paulson knew another reason a Lehman bailout could quickly become a public relations nightmare. Bush's brother, Jeb, the former governor of Florida, worked as an advisor to Lehman's private equity business. Bush's cousin, George H. Walker IV, was on the firm's executive committee. And then there was Paulson's brother, Richard. The press, needless to say, would have a field day. "We should make some calls," she urged him, suddenly suggesting they begin leaking to the press word that the government wouldn't be pursuing any bailout of Lehman. Paulson mulled over his dilemma. He had always opted to be cautious with the press and hated the very idea of leaking as a tactic. But he trusted Davis's instincts, and in any case, he preferred not to get his own hands dirty in the matter. "Do what we need to do," he told her. "Just, you know, don't have it be me on the record." As soon as Paulson awoke on Friday, he began poring through the morning papers, looking for evidence of Davis's handiwork. The message was supposed to have been made clear. Read our lips, no more bailouts. The mood in Washington was not hard to discern. There was no desire whatsoever for any further Wall Street rescues. All punditry could talk about was moral hazard, as if it were some sort of emerging disease that had just reached pandemic proportions. Bail out Lehman, the thinking went, and you will make bailouts the default solution at a time when no firm seems safe. And what could be more satisfying than having your decision, the buck stopped there, thank you very much, manifested on the front pages of the country's leading publications? Paulson first turned expectantly to the newspaper of financial record, the Wall Street Journal, and was sorely disappointed. The A1 article about the financial crisis merely tiptoed around the issue, without ever being forceful enough about it, he thought as he read the piece. As close as the reporter got to explaining his position was this sentence. Federal officials currently aren't expected to structure a bailout along the lines of the Bear transaction, or this past weekend's rescue of mortgage giants Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. The New York Times was even worse. But while the Treasury Department and Fed were working to broker an orderly sale of Lehman, it was unclear whether the Fed would stand behind any deal, particularly after the Bush administration took control of the nation's two largest mortgage finance companies only days ago. No, that didn't quite capture what they had been trying to convey, Paulson thought. He turned to the journal's editorial page, where the air was typically more rarefied, and was able to take solace, as conservatives so often had, in its hyper-intellectual and at times harsh right-wing opinions. The typically unsigned editorial was called Lehman's Fate, and its position was right out of Paulson's playbook. At least in the Bear case, the journal editorial read, there was some legitimate fear of systemic risk. The Federal Reserve's discount window hadn't yet been opened to investment banks, and so there was some chance of a larger liquidity panic. That's far less likely with Lehman. The discount window is now wide open to Merrill Lynch and Morgan Stanley, among others, and federal regulators have had months to inspect the value of Lehman's assets and its various counterparties. If the feds step in to save Lehman after Bear and Fannie Mae, we will no longer have exceptions forged in a crisis. We will have a new de facto federal policy of underwriting Wall Street that will encourage even more reckless risk-taking. Yes, yes, all true, Paulson thought as he finished the editorial. Still, it didn't go far enough. He needed somehow to make it clear to all the banks that there would be no handouts, no more Jamie deals. And he needed to do so in a way that would leave no room for misunderstanding. When he arrived at the office, Paulson walked down the hall into Michelle Davis's office and asked sullenly, "What do we do?" "I'd rather say today that we don't want to use our money, and on Sunday night have to explain why we were backed into a corner," Davis told him. "You want me to call Leisman?" she asked. Leisman was Steve Leisman, CNBC's economics reporter, known popularly as the Professor. Davis had a good relationship with him and had successfully leaked other information to him. Paulson considered him both intelligent and sympathetic to their cause. He could get the word out quickly and accurately. "Yes, the professor," Paulson smiled. "He'll know what to do with this." As Ed Herlihy sat in his office working on Bank of America's bid, he kept his TV on mute until at around 9:15 a.m., he saw the headline crawl across the bottom of CNBC's screen. Breaking news. Source. There will be no government money in the resolution of LEH situation. And quickly turned up the volume to hear what Steve Leisman was telling David Faber, the network's mergers reporter. "Let me start here with a comment that I just got from a person familiar with Paulson. State Secretary Treasurer Hank Paulson," Leisman explained. "He's saying there will be no government money in the resolution of this situation." Herlihy turned the volume even higher. "They're saying there are two things that make the Lehman deal different," Leisman continued. "The market's been aware and had time to prepare for over 6 months. And the second is the PDCF, that is, the access of the investment banks to the Fed's emergency window that now exists, to allow for an orderly process." It was a lot to take in, and the professor turned the floor over to his colleague. "David, what do you think of that?"
"An interesting gamble," Faber replied. "Would the government be willing to say, hey, you're on your own? There's divided opinion in terms of what the ultimate risk will be to the creditors, to everybody involved in the credit default swap market where Lehman currently is a counterparty on many trades." Leisman added, "I'm sure the Federal Reserve is looking for a situation where it can say, there is moral hazard out there. You will take a hit if you did not pay attention for the last 6 months." Herlihy couldn't believe what he was hearing, and ran into the conference room across the way where an army of bankers and Bank of America executives was mulling over documents. "Did you just see what they just said on CNBC?" Herlihy asked Curl, almost out of breath. Curl not only hadn't, but seemed slightly annoyed that he'd even been asked the question. "Look, guys, we got a real problem here,"
Herlihy insisted, after noticing he wasn't getting much of a reaction from anyone in the room. After Herlihy recounted the details of the Leesman interview, Curl only rolled his eyes. Why was Herlihy taking the CNBC report so seriously? To him, the channel was a professional rumor mill. "It's coming from Treasury," Herlihy stressed again. "That's Paulson. They're trying to send us a message." Herlihy was media savvy enough to know how the game worked. When he had been at Treasury just a week earlier, during the takeover of Fannie Freddie, he had watched the department deftly leak news out to the public through its favorite reporter, Leesman. The room turned sour, as even Curl acknowledged that Herlihy had a point. "How serious do you think they are?" Curl asked. Before heading back uptown for the second day of the BlackRock board meeting, John Thane decided to hold a conference call with his own board. With the markets gyrating and rumors flying, he wanted to make it clear publicly that Merrill was solid. Already there was a news report that morning quoting Malcolm Pauley, chief investment officer at Stewart Capital Advisors, saying, "I think the market's telling you that if Lehman is going to go away, Merrill is probably the next victim." Thane first briefed the board on recent market swings, which showed no sign of stopping. One look at the futures made it clear that stocks were likely to sink at the opening bell. With Merrill down 16% the previous day, things were only going to get worse. The discussion quickly turned to Lehman. Thane told the board what he knew, which wasn't too different from what had been reported in the papers, except that Thane was getting his information directly from Geithner. Bank of America and Barclays were both vying to buy Lehman. John Finnegan, a chief executive of the insurer Chubb, sounded worried. "Lehman is going down, and the shorts are coming after us next," he told Thane. "Tell me how this story is going to end differently." Thane, frustrated by the remark, had never liked being challenged. "We are not Lehman," he said, his eyes flashing behind his glasses, and then repeated for emphasis, "We're not Lehman." Regaining his usual composure, Thane calmly rehearsed the virtues of Merrill. "We have a wealth management business that's going to have value no matter what," he told the board. "And we own half of BlackRock, which would also have value no matter what. So our stock's not going to zero." Fuld was growing restless. It was 9:30 a.m. Lehman's stock opened down 9% to $3.84. And he hadn't heard from Diamond in over 12 hours. "So where are we?" Fold asked Diamond when he finally reached him. "I've literally just gotten the okay from my board that we can pursue this," said Diamond, who had arrived in New York from London after midnight the night before. "We've just begun doing diligence with your public filings." Before he continued, however, Diamond decided that he needed to be blunt with Fold. "To be honest," he said stiffly, "this is a horrible situation for you, because we're only going to be interested if the price is quite distressed." Fuld, leaning back in his desk chair, looked at Russo, who had taken a seat across the desk for the call. He understood. "You and I should talk because you should know exactly what my ideas are, what my plans are," Diamond said. He suggested meeting at noon at the Racquet and Tennis Club, a members-only establishment on Park Avenue and 52nd Street, where they would be able to get a private meeting room. No, you don't understand. I can't walk out of here," Fold insisted. "There's photographers all over the place. Why don't you come over here? We can sneak you in the back. I'll send my car for you." AIG shares fall 20% on mortgage woes, proclaimed the Reuters headline at 10:14 a.m. Catherine Seifert, a Standard & Poor's analyst, had just released a research note saying that the stock was falling on concerns about AIG's ability to shed its troubled mortgage-related assets, and we expect the shares to remain volatile as investors await news from the company. As he followed these stories with increasing alarm, Bob Willemstad decided to call Jamie Dimon. He was increasingly frustrated with the J.P. Morgan team and needed assurances. "Jamie, we're going to get downgraded," he told him. "You need to help me figure out how to get $18 billion. There's no plan for the end of September anymore," he added, referring to his plan to announce the results of his firm-wide review and a new strategy at the end of the month. He stopped to let that sink in and then continued, "You know, if you guys can't help us, tell me now, but we've got to do something this weekend. We hired you guys to do this," he said, his voice rising ever so slightly. "Listen, just tell me if you can't, just tell me now."
"Look, we want to make this work," Diamond said, sounding a contrite note. "Give me 5 minutes and I'll call you back."
When he phoned back, he apologized on behalf of the firm and said that he would take Black off the case. His other lieutenant, Doug Bronstein, who ran the firm's investment banking practice, would now be in charge. Bronstein, a no-nonsense dealmaker, had been entrusted with some of the firm's biggest transactions after working his way up the ranks, initially at First Boston in the 1980s, and then at Chase. He helped negotiate the firm's acquisition of J.P. Morgan, its purchase of Bank One, bringing Diamond with it, and then the Bear Stearns deal. "We're going to send Bronstein down with the team, and we're going to see what we can do about raising capital for you over the weekend." Diamond promised him that he'd keep the trains on the tracks. As he ended the conversation with Diamond, another call came in, Tim Geithner, who was finally getting back to Willemstad.
"So where are we?" Geithner asked.
"We're working on a capital raise," Willemstad explained.
"And we're talking to some bidders for assets that may come in this weekend. We expect to have some more information later in the day."
"We're going to send over some of our market guys this morning to help," Geithner told him in a tone that made it clear that this was not an offer, but an order.
"Keep me posted," Geithner said before hanging up. The conversation had lasted no more than 30 seconds. By now, Hank Paulson had become so agitated by the problems at Lehman that he scarcely noticed his assistant, Crystal West, trying to get his attention. Alistair Darling, the Chancellor of the Exchequer of Britain, was on the line. Paulson had gotten to know Darling over the past 2 years, and though they had visited each other on both sides of the Atlantic, they had not grown close. Paulson considered Darling more a politician than a businessman, and he had nothing like the experience that Paulson himself had had in financial markets. But he respected Darling's judgment and admired the quick and decisive action he had taken a year earlier, when Northern Rock, one of Britain's biggest mortgage lenders, was on the brink of failing. Darling had prevented a run on the bank by authorizing the Bank of England to lend Northern Rock billions of dollars to guarantee its deposits. That incident had been an early wake-up call for Paulson. Darling, who had just ended a day-long meeting in Nice with other European finance ministers, made a bit of chit-chat and, after an awkward pause, said that he was calling about Barclays. "You should know that we have serious concerns about this deal," he told Paulson sternly. Paulson tried to assuage him, explaining that there was another bidder, Bank of America, involved in the matter as well. He also spoke about the systemic importance of Lehman Brothers to the global economy and stressed how a deal between Barclays and Lehman would turn Barclays into an international giant with the might of Wall Street behind it. Paulson explained that he was trying to put together an industry consortium to aid a bid by either Barclays or Bank of America. Nonetheless, with characteristic British understatement, Darling continued to express apprehension about any potential purchase and said adamantly, "Barclays shouldn't take on any more risk than they could possibly manage." Paulson, confidently dismissing his concerns, promised him he'd keep him updated throughout the weekend. Bob Diamond arrived at Lehman's headquarters in Fold's Mercedes and was taken through the back entrance, avoiding the battalion of cameras stationed out front. Hoping to keep any of Lehman's staff from seeing the visitor, the firm's security team shuttled him up in the building's freight elevator and hurriedly led him to Fold's office. Fold offered him a cup of coffee, and between Fold's anxiety and Diamond's not having slept, they both looked like hell. Diamond was clearly in a rush to get to Simpson Thacker, where his team of bankers had just begun diligence, and he wanted to dig into the numbers himself. He walked Fold through the day's plan and then discussed the various synergies and overlaps between the two firms. In the middle of Diamond's presentation, Fold interrupted him and told him there was something he wanted to get off his chest. An almost frightening intensity came over him as he began to speak. "Look into the whites of my eyes," he said. "There isn't enough room for both of us at the top here. We both know that." He paused and stared at Diamond intently.
I'm willing to step aside to make this work for the firm. For Fuld, it was the biggest concession he could offer, to give up the firm he loved. For Diamond, the moment was somewhat baffling. He had never imagined Fuld would stay. He didn't want him to. If there is a way for me to help with a transition, help with clients, you know, I will do that, Fuld offered. I've always heard you were a good man, Diamond told Fuld consolingly. Now you've proven that. After a 20-minute crawl through traffic on the FDR Drive, Chris Flowers finally arrived at AIG's offices just before noon. He was led to a meeting room where Willemstad, Schreiber, Stephen J. Benzinger, the firm's CFO, and a team of others were waiting. Schreiber immediately passed around a one-page summary of the firm's cash outflows that was set up like a calendar. Each day from Friday through the next Wednesday was marked with various scenarios, depending on the outcome of Moody's decision about its credit rating. If the executives hadn't yet come to appreciate the full extent of the conundrum in which they now found themselves, Schreiber's document put it into stark relief. By next Wednesday, the calendar indicated, the parent company would be negative $5 billion, with a shortfall each successive day only growing worse. Flowers' eyes widened as he studied the numbers. You guys have a real problem here. Yes, but we should be okay if we can make the capital raise work, Willemstad said. Have you guys thought about Chapter 11? Flowers blurted out. It was as if he had touched the third rail. Why are you using words like that? Benzinger asked, clearly upset. I can assure you, Flowers told him, that if you don't pay people $5 billion on Wednesday, they're going to be really, really upset. So you can call it whatever you want, but they are not going to be happy if you don't pay them on Wednesday. Just then, Jamie Dimon called back and was patched into the conference room's speakerphone. Schreiber described the potential cash flow problems and their plans to fix them. I've begun putting together a process for the weekend, he said, explaining how they'd reach out to possible suitors beginning that afternoon. He also walked through the company's various divisions and the amount of cash that each had on hand. Before Schreiber could continue with his inventory, Diamond cut him off. You're a smart guy, but you're running a fucked-up process. The worst-case scenario that Schreiber was describing wasn't anywhere near bad enough, Diamond insisted, and scoffed, You guys have no idea what you're doing. This is amateurish. It's pathetic. Even worse, Diamond didn't think that they had an accurate read of their financial data. As far as he could tell, Schreiber was simply reading off a sheet of siloed information that had never been aggregated and analyzed in one piece. You guys need to get a handle on the numbers, he said. The real numbers. You need to sit down with those numbers and figure out the size of the real hole, not the made-up hole. How big is the securities lending? You have to go contract by contract, like bottoms up, real work. Then you need to make a list of who can help you fill it. This isn't like, you know, you're going to be late on your credit card bill. Willemstad just stared at the speakerphone in silence. He knew this routine well from their days with Sandy Weil. This was Jamie the hothead. Better to shrug it off, Willemstad thought. The worst part of Diamond's tirade, he knew, was that he might be right. As the AIG team awkwardly attempted to get the conversation back on a less hostile footing, Flowers suggested they call Warren Buffett. He didn't know Buffett well, and the last time they had spoken, Flowers had tried to get him interested in buying Bear Stearns during that fateful weekend in March. In times of crisis, when a big check had to be written almost immediately, Buffett was the obvious man to turn to. Warren, Flowers said enthusiastically, after reaching Buffett, as if they were best friends. He reminded him of their past dealing, and then immediately explained the purpose of his call. He was staring at a piece of paper, he said, that showed that AIG would soon run out of money. He told Buffett that the spreadsheet was so basic and so poorly done that I might have used it to track my grocery bill. Hearing that Buffett was amused by the comment, Flowers continued, They're a bunch of morons. And paused meaningfully before saying, But there's a lot of value here. He explained that he was looking for Buffett to invest $10 billion of capital in AIG. He hoped, in fact, that they could make an investment together.
Buffett, however, wasn't especially interested in getting mixed up in such a mess. "You know, I don't have as much money as I used to," he said with a laugh. "I'm kind of low on cash." He also wasn't exactly sure he wanted to step into a battle between Hank Greenberg and Eli Broad, who were both waging war against the company. The only thing he might be willing to take a look at, he told Flowers, was AIG's property and casualty business. "Listen, there might be a real opportunity here," Flowers agreed. "Let me get Willemstad to at least call you." Flowers returned to the room and told them Buffett was an unlikely candidate, but urged Willemstad to contact him. Willemstad, who had never met Buffett, called and began his pitch, but before he could get very far into it, Buffett stopped him. "I've looked over the 10K," he said. "The company is too complicated. I don't have enough confidence to do that. Look, nothing is going to work with us, so don't waste your time. You've got plenty to do." But then he held out one glimmer of hope. "If you wanted to sell some assets that I might have some interest in, but I don't know." Willemstad thanked him for his time and consideration and slammed the phone down in frustration. By midday, rumors were now rampant at Lehman Brothers that the board might be about to fire Fuld, with the stock trading down another 9.7% to $3.71 a share. The possibility was being discussed openly, not only throughout the office, but in the media as well. By now, the anger was also becoming increasingly palpable on the trading floor among the firm's staff. Lehman's employees were unique on Wall Street in that they owned a quarter of the company's shares. For all the complaints about Wall Street being short-term oriented, most Lehman employees had a 5-year vesting period, which meant huge sums of their own wealth were tied up in the firm without the ability to sell their shares. And as of Friday, those shares had lost 93% of their value since January 31st. $10 billion had disappeared. Fuld, who owned 1.4% of the company, some 10.9 million shares, had lost $649.2 million. To make matters worse, in a cruel irony, Lehman employees were sent a memorandum that morning saying that the unrestricted shares that they did own outright, they could not sell. It was the standard blackout notice they received around earnings every quarter, preventing them from selling shares for several weeks. Reports of Fuld's possible ouster reached new heights when word spread that morning that John D. McComber, one of Lehman's board members and the former CEO of the chemical giant Celanese Corporation, had arrived at the building and was headed for the 31st floor. Almost a dozen people were milling about Fuld's corner office when they saw McComber, who was 80 years old, hobbling down the hallway toward them. Several began to leave as McComber got to the door, expecting they would soon be asked to excuse themselves. "Stay," McComber ordered them. Fuld, looking haggard, greeted McComber with a handshake. He didn't think he was getting fired, but he could sense the nervousness in the room. "I want to talk to you," McComber said. And though for a moment some of the bankers thought he indeed intended to tell Fuld that his services were no longer required, he instead launched, to everyone's surprise, into a rousing speech to rally the troops. "I want everyone in the room to know that I know that you guys have done a good job," he said. "This was just bad luck. We are 100% behind all of you." Fuld's board, it seemed, was still loyally Fuld's board. Rajan Cohen was still over at Sullivan & Cromwell's Midtown offices, trying to coax Bank of America into buying Lehman. But he could tell something had gone wrong. Greg Curl's body language had changed, and the B of A team seemed as if it had slowed down, as if it had already decided against bidding. Cohen, who was one of the few lawyers in the city who had direct access to Tim Geithner, dialed his office to report his suspicions that the government's hard line against offering any help had scared Bank of America away. "I don't think this deal can get done without government assistance," Cohen stressed to Geithner. "They may be bluffing us, and they may be bluffing you, but we can't afford to call that bluff." Geithner, who had expressed similar worries to Paulson the day before, but had been told to stand down, was succinct in his response. "You can't count on government assistance." At about 2:20 p.m., Just as Lehman's shares fell another 6% to $3.59, Hank Paulson, visibly frazzled, ran downstairs and out of the Treasury building to head to the airport. Dan Jester, Jim Wilkinson, and Paulson's assistant, Crystal West, jumped in his Suburban with him. Christopher Cox was planning to meet them at the airplane. On a call just hours earlier, he and Geithner had officially determined that something needed to be done about Lehman. If they really were going to convene all the CEOs on Wall Street and try to urge them to come up with a private market solution, now was the time to do it. Otherwise, by Monday, Lehman would be unsalvageable. "We have the weekend," he reminded them. They settled on setting up a meeting at 6 p.m. at the New York Fed. Geithner's office wouldn't start calling all the CEOs until just past 4 p.m., after the market had closed. The last thing they could afford was for news of the meeting to leak. Paulson, who usually made the trip to New York on U.S. Airways, which offered a government discount — Wendy had always given him grief about flying in a private jet — arranged to charter a plane to New York using his NetJets account. He couldn't afford to be delayed. The matter at hand was too important, and the weather was atrocious. If anything, he was worried the plane wouldn't even be able to take off. As they sped toward Dulles to catch the flight, Paulson, almost inaudibly, said, "God help us." Chapter 14. Lloyd Blankfein was milling about the green room at the Hilton Hotel on 53rd Street at 6th Avenue, waiting to make a speech at the Service Nation Summit, an annual conference coordinated by a coalition of nonprofits that promotes volunteerism in America. Dressed in his customary blue suit and pressed white shirt and blue tie, he had come to give one of the keynote addresses, following Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger and preceding Hillary Clinton, to discuss Goldman's 10,000 Women nonprofit program, which fostered business and management education for women in developing and emerging economies. Clinton, who had been at the other side of the green room returning phone calls, now strolled over to him and politely asked if she might speak before him. She had to get to a dinner, she explained. Blankfein was a big fan. He had given her some $4,600 in donations and had endorsed her in the Democratic primaries over Barack Obama. Since he had no pressing business himself, Blankfein gladly agreed to the switch. 2 minutes later, however, Blankfein's cell phone rang. "We got a call from the Fed. There's a meeting at 6 p.m. for all the bank CEOs," his assistant told him, sounding simultaneously excited and nervous. "Paulson, Geithner, and Cox are supposed to be there." This was it, Blankfein thought. The big one. Paulson was going to have the families meet to try to save Lehman. Blankfein looked at his watch. It was already getting close to 5 p.m. Schwarzenegger was still chattering away, and he had just given his spot away to Clinton. He tried to reach Gary Cohn, Goldman's co-president, to find out what was going on, but didn't get an answer. Cohn was likely still on the shuttle back from D.C. after testifying at a hearing for the Committee on Energy and Natural Resources. Blankfein sheepishly walked over to Clinton. "Remember I told you that you could go ahead of me?" he asked. "Well, I have an emergency. I just got a call that I have to go to the Fed." Clinton looked at him as if she didn't understand what he was saying. Embarrassed, he tried to explain. "They usually don't call me up when it's something really pleasant, since they've done this a total of never." She half smiled sympathetically and let him speak first. Jamie Dimon could hardly believe his bad luck. He was supposed to be home by 7 p.m. to have dinner with his daughter Julia's boyfriend's parents, whom he and his wife were meeting for the first time. Julia, his eldest daughter, had been begging her father all week to be on his best behavior and to make a good impression. And now, the Fed was calling an all-hands-on-deck meeting of Wall Street's top brass. Dimon called his wife, Judy, who was well accustomed to receiving calls like this from her husband. "Geithner's called us down to the Fed," Dimon told her. "I don't know how long it'll go. I'll try to get there as soon as I can." Dimon hung up the phone and hurried down the hallway to tell Steve Black the news. Black had just confirmed his plans to play in a tournament at Purchase Country in Westchester, teeing off the next morning at 7 o'clock. "We're going down to the Fed," Dimon told him. "You've got to be fucking kidding me," he replied. Black immediately called the Purchase Club back. "Sorry," he said with a weary sigh. I was only kidding. Take me out.
Brian Moynihan, Bank of America's president of global corporate and investment banking, was reviewing some of Lehman's assets valuations at Sullivan & Cromwell's Midtown offices when Ken Lewis phoned from Charlotte. "We got a call from Geithner's office," Lewis told him. "You have to go down to the Fed. They're going to do a meeting to figure out what to do about this whole situation." Moynihan rushed downstairs, bolted without an umbrella through the revolving doors and into the pouring rain, and commandeered one of Sullivan & Cromwell's town cars to take him down to the New York Federal Reserve. Just as the car was making its way into Park Avenue traffic, and he dried himself off, Moynihan's cell phone rang again. "There's been some crossed wires, Mr. Moynihan," one of Tim Geithner's assistants told him. "I know we had invited your firm to this meeting." "Yes, I'm on my way down right now," he assured her. After a brief pause, she said, "Given your bank's role in the merger discussions, we believe it would be inappropriate for you to attend the meeting." Moynihan had gotten no farther than 8 blocks before turning around and calling Lewis to tell him the news. John Mack and Colm Kelleher, Morgan Stanley's chief financial officer, were sitting in the back seat of Mack's Audi, having hurried to the car just 10 minutes earlier after Mack's secretary had instructed them to get down to the Fed as soon as possible. "This must be Lehman," Kelleher had said as they rushed out. Not only was the rain pelting the roof furiously, but they were now sitting in bumper-to-bumper traffic on the West Side Highway, still miles away from their destination. "We're not fucking moving," Mack said, repeatedly checking his watch. "We're never going to get there," Kelleher agreed. Mack's driver, John, a former police officer, noticed the bicycle lane running along the highway, a project of the Bloomberg administration to encourage walking and cycling. "Boss, that bike lane on the right, where does it go?" John asked, craning his neck back at them. Mack's face lit up. "It goes all the way down to the Battery." "Fuck it," the driver said, as he found a break in the street divider and inched the car onto the bike lane, speeding down it. Hank Paulson's Cessna Citation X touched down on runway 119 at New Jersey's Teterboro Airport at 4:40 p.m. The pilot, navigating through a torrential downpour and 50-mile-an-hour winds, threw the switch on the flaps and taxied to the main gate, where the Secret Service was waiting in 2 black Chevrolet Suburbans. Now, as they inched their way through the Holland Tunnel toward Manhattan in rush-hour traffic, Paulson took a call from Greg Curl of Bank of America and Chris Flowers, the firm's banker, who had completed their assessment of the Lehman numbers. "We're going to need the government to help to make this work," Curl told Paulson bluntly, and then launched into a series of proposed deal terms, conditions that would have to be met in order for this transaction to take place. Paulson listened patiently, even if he had a hard time understanding why Curl felt he had the upper hand to the point that he could dictate the conditions. But as Paulson himself liked to say, "You only need 2 girls at the dance to call it an auction." And under the circumstances, he needed B of A to be one of them. If he could just keep Bank of America around long enough to close a deal with Barclays, he'd have succeeded. Paulson handed his cell phone over to Dan Jester, who had, ironically, worked for Flowers at Goldman in the Financial Services Group in the 1990s, who took notes. Curl told Jester that Bank of America would agree to the deal only if the government was willing to take $40 billion of losses on Lehman's assets. "We've been through the books, and they're a mess," Curl explained, referring to Lehman's bountiful toxic assets. Bank of America, he said, would be willing to split the first $1 billion of losses with the government, but after that, the next $40 billion, the government would have to guarantee. In exchange, Curl told him, the bank would give the government warrants, the option to buy shares at a later date, for Bank of America, with a strike price of $45 a share. B of A shares closed that day at $33.74. Jester mouthed the figures to Paulson as Curl relayed them. Both men shook their heads, knowing full well that, under these terms, a deal was never going to happen. As the Suburban made its way through downtown Manhattan, Paulson called Geithner to strategize. It was already past 6 p.m. when the meeting was set to begin. They figured they would let the CEOs stir for a bit until Paulson arrived, just to let them know they meant business.
33 Liberty Street, the New York Federal Reserve Building, is an imposing, fortress-like sanctuary of old-fashioned, traditional finance. In 1927, Margaret Law, a critic for Architecture magazine, wrote that the three-year-old building had a quality which, for lack of a better word, I can best describe as epic. Deep below the limestone and sandstone building,